In this part of Focus 580, we'll be looking at some recent trends in marriage. Who gets married and why? How people think about the institution. And whether or not we can say that marriage and how people think about it is some sort of important social barometer, says something about where we are. Just recently, we had been collecting articles, and it seemed like at the moment there's an awful lot in popular media about marriage, including one story that perhaps people have seen that was published in the New York Times, making the assertion that 50, I believe, if I'm remembering this right, it was 51%. Yeah, here it is, I had it right in front of me. 51% of women are now living without spouse. Now, some people came along and looked at that and said, well, maybe the New York Times included some women in here that really shouldn't be in there to get you that kind of number. But the fact of the matter is that we do think an awful lot about marriage and the state of marriage. So we wanted to have a conversation, and this may indeed be just the first of some numbers of conversations we have on this subject, but we want to have a conversation on the subject. And we have as our guest this morning Kay Heimowitz. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in New York City. She's also contributing editor of City Journal. She's authored a number of books, including Liberation's Children and Ready or Not. She's also written extensively on education and childhood in America in articles for The New York Times and The Washington Post, among other publications. She is the author of a recently published book titled Marriage and Caste in America. The subtitle is Separate and Unequal Families in a Post-Marital Age. Ivan D. Is the publisher. They're out of Chicago. Questions welcome here as we move through the hour. People want to be a part of the conversation. They certainly can do that. All we ask of people who call in is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep moving, get in as many people in as possible. But certainly, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Heimowitz, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
We appreciate it. As I explained, I think that we started out simply collecting articles, things that were published in newspapers and magazines that were about marriage and parenthood, looking at it in different ways. Most of these were things that were aimed at highlighting what somebody saw as a problem. And, maybe the last thing that finally we saw was this, the story that was in the New York Times. And I think we said, oh, well, we've got to do something. We've got to at least have some conversations with some people about what's going on, about where we are with marriage. And maybe indeed the place to start is to say that no matter what you think about marriage, no matter what you think about the changes that have happened in the last couple of generations, no matter whether you think that those are good or bad, they are important because they are something of a social barometer. They do tell us something about who we are and where we are, right?
Well, they do, to be sure. But I think that the story you're talking about from the New York Times actually really missed the boat. Not only was the data all messed up because they included in that 50% of unmarried women, teenagers from 15 to 19, but in addition, they left out the major story, which I believe most people don't quite understand, and that is this. The marital breakdown of the last 40 years that you just referred to has hit Americans very disproportionately. Low-income women are far less likely to get married and far more likely to get divorced than higher income, more and specifically college-educated women are. And it has led to a real problem because the children of those low-income women who are likely to be single mothers are less likely to get the benefits of living with two parents. And we now know, after decades of research, that children who grow up with single mothers, poor or not, are at greater risk of all sorts of problems. So what we're talking about, as I put it, is a kind of developing caste system where we're going to see a self-perpetuating line of single mothers and their children who are not doing especially well.
Now, before people start calling us, I would imagine that you would agree that it is not absolutely necessarily the case that a single parent family, they're going to their kids are going to be at risk because people will call and then give us examples of single parents, both men and women, who have done okay. It sounds as if, though, the qualification you have to put on here is that the more resources that you have, the better off you're going to be and the better the outcome is likely to be.
I think that the implications are a little bit broader than that when we look at a lot of the data that's come out. First of all, let me address your first point. There's no question that there are many single parents who are doing a fabulous job. The children are doing great, and everything is going well. And on the other side, you have many children and married parents who are doing miserably. Maybe the marriages are a mess, and maybe the kids are a mess, and we all know those stories. And I'm not, it's not that I'm not influenced by those stories. We all know what we know. But when you look at the broad data, when you look at the census numbers, when you look at the millions upon millions of children who have been affected by the family revolution of the last 40 years, you begin to see certain trends. And what we know is that, in fact, on average, and, you know, we are not all on average but as individuals, but on average, children do better when they grow up with their married biological parents. And it's, it's no use. There's no use really arguing with that point. That is a sociological fact at this point. Then the question is why, and that's the second point that you raised. You implied that this had to do with more resources, and it depends what you mean by resources. But I think we need to be careful to not limit ourselves to what I think you're moving towards, which is what I call the strength in numbers thesis. That is, that the reason marriage is better for kids is because there are two parents who are better than one. You've got more income. You've got more hands to deal with problems. More brains. More of everything.
Mm-hmm.
What we see, though, when we really try to look at the variables, is that there's something more involved, because when you have kids growing up in step families, for instance, where there are two parents, they don't do as well. They don't look any much better than kids who grow up with single mothers. And when you look at kids who grow up with cohabiting parents, they don't look as good as the kids who grow up with married parents. There seems to be something about marriage itself that promotes child well-being and encourages couples to stay together, because those cohabiting couples tend to break up at much higher rates also.
Well, how do you explain that then? Do you think that has something to do with the fact that if people are married, then the kind of commitment that they are making, emotional, psychological, every other commitment to their children, is greater than it would be if they were not married?
I think in many cases, yes, but it's also that marriage as a social institution, we think of it as just a sort of private arrangement between two adults, but it is a social institution, and that means it carries with it a variety of social messages, a variety of ideas about how to live your life. One of those ideas is that you want to build wealth. People who get married are often, as soon as possible, trying to think about buying a home, buying a car, saving towards vacations, and that sort of thing. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, you'll find that married couples of similar education. Let me backtrack a little bit on that. If you look at married couples versus unmarried couples, and control for education and control for income and all of that, you find that married couples are just more likely to build wealth. There's nothing that's worse for your wealth accumulation than getting divorced. So there's something about the institution of marriage which generates this idea of wealth accumulation, but also of child-centeredness. You find in married couple families much more orientation towards the child's development. It's what I call the mission. It's kind of the central purpose and goal of marriage, for at least in middle-class marriage. And you, it's not that single parents aren't, again, I need to clarify, it's not that single parents can't also be partakers in the mission, that is, people who are devoted to their child's development, their social, emotional, and cognitive development, but they are less likely to do so. Children in single-parent homes watch more television. They have less supervision over their homework and so on and so forth. Mm.
Just, I wanted just to ask a basic question about marriage. It seems to be the case, and I'm, again, I suppose different people would give you different numbers, but that it seems to be the case that the rate of marriage, the number of people who marry, is less than it was maybe 50 years ago. There certainly would have been a point where almost everybody got married, and they got married, people got married when they finished high school, or people did go to college, they got married when they, sometime during college or sometime after, and that what is happening now is that the rate of marriage has declined, that people are waiting longer to get married, and that the way that people think about marriage has changed somewhat. At least this seems to be one of the concerns that you have, and I think that other people have, and that the idea, and this is not necessarily a new idea, but the idea is that a big part of marriage is companionship. It's the personal benefits that the adults get from having this bond, this relationship with the other adult. What do you make out of all of that? And why do you think that that's happened? And do you, in fact, think that's a problem?
Let me take your first point first, which is that there are fewer people who are married, or people don't get married as often. Actually, that's not true. It sure seems that way from most of the media reports. But the Census Bureau predicts that 90% of all women will marry at some point. There's no question, as you mentioned, that people are getting married later, much later, especially college-educated men and women. It used to be just 20, 30 years ago that people, the average age of marriage was in the early 20s. It is now in the mid-20s and up, depending on whether you are male or female and whether you're educated or not. So Americans are actually still very marriage-oriented. They want to get married. Their attitudes, if you look at surveys, they're very pro-marriage. They think of marriage as a very important part of a fulfilling and satisfying life. They don't judge people who don't have that, but they want that for themselves, according to the surveys. This is what's changed, and you alluded to this. What's changed is that people think about marriage now as a personal relationship between two adults, and no longer imagine it as they once did, as largely, if not primarily, about raising the next generation, about child rearing. So that when you had this, what I call the unmarried revolution of the late 60s and early 70s, where people began to say, well, you know, if I'm not happy in this marriage, we don't stay together for the sake of the kids anymore. That was the idea that people used to have. The idea at that time became, as long as I'm happy, my children will be better off. And people went under that assumption for some decades, and it wasn't until about the mid-90s that sociologists and psychologists looked at the numbers, looked at what they were finding with child well-being, and realized that no, in fact, it wasn't clear at all that children were better off just because their parents were getting divorced and when they were unhappy. So this is what I think is key to the change in marriage. It's not that people don't want to get married. It's not that they won't get married. It's that they don't see it as essentially connected to childbearing and childrearing.
Mm-hmm. Just to stay with this idea of people considering that the personal satisfaction of the partners is really important, I'm sure that there would be some people who would make the argument that in a sense that is good, that can potentially lead to a stronger kind of relationship if having a strong relationship is really important to you. So now, on the other hand, I suppose the downside is that means that the institution of marriage somehow becomes more, in a sense, it's both stronger and it's more fragile.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, I should also indicate that if you we've looked at surveys about happiness in marriage, and even with easier divorce, and even with about a 40% divorce rate, people are still no happier than they were before the divorce revolution. So I'm not sure that we've really created happier marriages, despite making people freer to exit them. The point is, though, that the most people really do want to be married, but don't necessarily see that as having much to do with childbearing. If you know, I was struck recently with a advice columnist on online magazine that I read, who was telling a young woman who was pregnant with her boyfriend's baby. I guess she was about 22, and she had been seeing the guy for about 2 years. She said, "Well, what should I do? And you know, and I think maybe I want to have the baby, but my parents are freaking out." And the advice columnist wrote back and said, "You know, the first thing you ought to do is think about your baby and what kind of future you're going to give her, and you ought to be talking about marriage and thinking very seriously about marriage." And people wrote in enraged, saying, "How dare you tell this young woman to be thinking about marriage? It's such a big decision." In other words, she was about to have this child, which seems to me an even larger decision, and people were not willing to really think that maybe marriage was in order under those circumstances. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that clearly it seems to have happened, and you can tell me what you think, is that the stigma that was once attached to a woman who had a baby who wasn't married has reduced significantly. At the same time, it was also, I guess, my understanding that that particularly recently, and particularly among young women, that out of wedlock births had actually gone down. At the same time that the stigma seems to have been somewhat lifted off of having a baby, even if you were not married.
Oh, well, the stigma is certainly gone, and the out-of-wedlock birth rate has zoomed to astronomical levels. It's now at 37%. 37% of all American children, are born to unmarried women. And in many cases, those women are congratulated by their peers and by people they know, and even I've seen in some cases by their ministers for being very brave to have these children alone. So not only is the stigma gone, it's sometimes this is even applauded. So I think we've gotten confused about what's at stake here. The children are kind of secondary in people thinking about this. The focus is on the adult's choices, the adult's happiness. And I want to be clear here. I know many couples who have broken up, some in my own family, and I can't imagine that those couples should have stayed together. I see all the reasons that they broke up, and despite the unhappiness for the children, I understand why it happened. That does not mean that we can't think as a society about ways to improve the quality of marriage and improve the chances that children will grow up with their married biological parents.
So you are not going to take that position that many people might have once, that staying together for the good of the children, that's not necessarily...
I think in some cases it can be necessarily a good idea. It depends on the marriage. You know, these things are very individual, and there are many marriages, I believe, that are breaking up a little too casually. Mm-hmm. Many people don't understand what the impact is on their children. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, was to get that information clearly out there. But it doesn't mean that people shouldn't, I certainly am not saying that, we should get rid of divorce. I do think we maybe want to think about making it a little less casual, a little less easy.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Kay Heimowitz. She is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in New York City and also contributing editor of City Journal. She's written extensively on education and childhood in America and articles for many publications, including New York Times and Washington Post. She is also author of the book Marriage and Caste in America. The subtitle is Separate and Unequal Families in a Postmarital Age, published by Ivan D. in Chicago. Questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone here calling from a nearby community of Savoy, someone on a cell phone, so we will go there to start off with callers. Line 4. Hello.
Hi, David. Very interesting program. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of quick comments and then a question, and I'll go ahead and ring off. When I was growing up, I'm in my 50s now, but my mother said, once you get married and have kids, you'll pick your friends by the way your friends raise their children. And sure enough, you do gravitate towards, I guess, people who raise their children similar to, your beliefs or whatever. I do feel that when you're married, and everyone's different, and I have no data to back this up, but I know friends who've been married for 30, 35 years, and they never had children, and they just don't appear to be happy, or they go around and trying to fill their time, trying to fill the void. They go to the point of going to movies. They go to separate movies. everyone's different, but I do think when you add children to the equation, it does add something to the marriage. But that's my point of view, and everyone's entitled to their own point of view. I do have a question, though. I was wondering if your guest could speak to just the strangest phenomenon I find is women who have children out of wedlock for whatever reason, they seem to go, and again, just from economics, they seem to go back and gravitate to having additional children out of wedlock from different men. And just you look at that and you go, my God, economically, do you have any idea what kind of hole you're billing yourself into? And they just, you talk to them and they go, well, I'd like to have a baby. And, I find that amazing, and I don't know if there's any, rationale for it. But anyway, I thought you'd enjoy those comments, and I'm enjoying the show. I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
All right.
I will make one comment about the issue about childlessness that might be not help my argument very much, but here it is. Actually, the surveys show that childless adults are often happier than adults with children. Although, and actually, your happiness levels often go up when the children leave home for many couples, but. Be that as it may, most married couples will have children. The vast majority of them will have children, that's the way that's always been and continues to be even today. But about women having children by a number of different men and never marrying, this is and has been for some time a big problem in many inner city communities. And continues to be. We've been able to do something about the teenage birth rate. Perhaps your listeners have heard about this. That's gone down quite a bit. But what has not changed is that women still are not getting married in the inner city community, particularly among blacks. The out of wedlock birth rate among blacks is 70%. Now, that number is so high that it means that it isn't just the very poor who are doing this. And this is why I keep talking about this. It's not exactly an economic question. It has economic consequences, but I think the reasons that people decide to have a baby when they're married or not, it has more to do with culture. It has more to do with their attitudes and with the set of attitudes that they've grown up with and have been taught and that are shared by the people around them. And among blacks in particular, the assumption is that you do not need to be married when you have your child. And unfortunately, what we now know is that your children are not going to be as, on average, are not going to do as well if you don't marry. And the kids in those, the 30% of children, black children who are born to married parents have a much better hope in life than those who are not.
Hmm. Well, why do you think that, if indeed that is true, why do you think that that is true? That attitude that says that you don't need to be married to if you're going to have a child?
Well, as I said before, this is an attitude, an idea, a cultural set of norms that developed after the 1960s through the unmarriage revolution. It was a product of feminism and the sexual revolution and increasing sense of liberation and individualism. That said, you know, we don't believe in these old traditional forms of the way to live life. We want as much freedom as possible, and that meant freedom to divorce or freedom to have children, however we might decide to do it. So I believe that's what happened. I think that in addition, the Black family was fragile anyway because of for obvious reasons, because of slavery and the Jim Crow era. And so Blacks were hit especially hard by this unmarried revolution. But I want to make clear, I'm not just talking about Blacks. This is, 25% of white children are being born to unmarried mothers also.
Let's take some more calls. Let's go to Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I have a substantive question, but I wanted to point out that the Manhattan Institute was founded by William Casey, head of the CIA during Reagan, and has launched such notables as Charles Murray's Bell Curve. It's funded by the Bradley Foundation and the Olin Foundation, some of the biggest funders of right-wing think tanks. Be that you can go to media transparency. I think it'd be important to have when these pundits are on to have some kind of introduction that we know everyone has an agenda. So, the substantive question is that you just mentioned African Americans. There's a whole legacy of living outside of marriage in the African American cultural milieu, and it was called slavery. In the poor white community, we had indentured servants. We had a long history of servitude. It came out of the English tradition. There was not much paid attention to the lower class as far. And I think caste is important, but class is also important. And I think this idea that there was this traditional era that you're hearkening back to and saying that the 60s changed everything is, frankly, a bunch of hooey.
Well, I would like to respond. Number one,
yeah, please do.
You're invited.
Perhaps you didn't hear me say that I believe that slavery is part of the reason, a large part of the reason, that the Black family was particularly vulnerable to the unmarried revolution. So we agree on that. As for whether there was ever a traditional era, you know, look, I'm not one of these people who thinks that the 50s was the best time of all worlds. But I will tell you that 80% of Black children were living with their two married parents at that time, and the even higher percentage of white children. So something was different when it came to marriage. So instead of trying these sort of ad hominem arguments, yes, you know, Manhattan Institute is usually described as a conservative think tank, and
feminine argument, if you will.
Yeah, that is not an argument. Let's talk about what's happened that's creating this, that's furthering our rates of poverty and inequality, and that is that the continuing breakdown of the family. That is actually should not be a conservative idea, since it is, we are talking about greater possibilities for opportunity for poor and low-income people. I don't think that that's going to be possible without reviving and strengthening the low-income family.
How about just raising their income, like having provisions like family benefits, a higher minimum wage and other things like that. The point I'm making is the lowest quintile in this country has been taking it on the chin, and that's where a lot of the problem is. It's also true that what feminism has done positively is that women no longer have to feel condemned to stay in an abusive relationship, and I think the statistics that show how well people do in a married family should include, the kind of problems that happen to children when they have to stay in an abusive family situation. Abusive family situation is surely much worse than a single parent family. I hope someone else picks up the challenge. Also, Charles Murray was also one of the people. I don't know if I mentioned him. The bell curve, a 15% difference in IQ from a genetic reason. Now, I'm not saying that you share that point of view, but the Manhattan Institute has been...
Charles Murray did not write that the bell curve under the Manhattan Institute's auspices, just so you're clear about that. As for abusive relationships, You know, this is the point that comes up almost every time I talk about this, my book, and there's no question that there should be easy divorce, easy ways for women to get out of abusive marriages, and there are, and at some point in our past, it wasn't so easy. So, you know, we absolutely agree on that. But we also know, if you look at the sociologists who have studied divorce carefully, what they're finding is that most marriages do not break up because of abuse. Those are the very rare ones. It's mostly a kind of dissatisfaction, in many cases a low-level dissatisfaction that children aren't even aware of. So let's make our distinctions here. Nobody disagrees that nobody, woman or children, should be stuck in an abusive arrangement. However, that is not an argument against I think against what I'm trying to say is let's increase the number or the percentage of children who are growing up with their married parents, married healthy parents, and those numbers I think we really can increase because most marriages do not end because of abusive relationships. As for the other point about increasing minimum wage and so forth, when I make the argument that marriages has entwined with our increasing rates of inequality, I'm not saying that's the only cause of inequality, but I am saying it is very much part of it. And I also think that it makes it harder when children are growing up in single-parent homes and they're low income and they're living in bad neighborhoods to begin with, and the school systems are not very good. You've got a kind of self-perpetuating and self-reinforcing situation. I mean, one of the first things that married couples do, no matter what their income level, is try to figure out how to get their kids into the best school possible. Now, many single mothers do this as well. But as I said before, this child-centeredness, this orientation towards the mission, seems to be more associated with marriage, American marriage, middle-class marriage, than it is with a single parenthood. And, you know, it's not not necessarily politically correct to say so, but that seems to be what the correlations show.
Just real quickly, let me ask you this question, because I know that some people who do family history would make the argument that the kinds of changes in the family and attitudes about marriage, as we move to this idea that what marriage is about is the satisfaction of the partners, they didn't start in the 1960s, that in fact they are rooted into the early years of the 20th century. And at least they go back before World War II, before the pill, before the second wave of feminism. And to blame all that on what was happening in the 60s is just what we saw then was actually the culmination of trends that go back further but were sort of knocked off the tracks by the Depression and then World War II. That it's not something that just started in the 1960s.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more about that. I do think that the urge to be able to find, you know, set out on one's own, to be independent, to be autonomous, to pursue one's happiness however one wants to, all of that is part of our kind of American ethos and goes very deeply into our roots. I totally agree with you about that. And by the 1920s, we were beginning to see a lot of the behaviors that we now associate with the sexual revolution of the 60s. And you're quite right, during the Depression and World War II, people got shell-shocked and turned much more conservative in their behaviors. So, however, the fact is that not much of this happened until the late 1960s. When you look at the divorce rate and the out-of-wedlock birth rates, they remain more or less stable, a little bit of an incline until we get to the late 60s, where they just shoot up like a rocket.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I will quickly introduce again our guest, Kay Heimowitz. She is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute in New York. They do have a website. If you're interested in finding out where they come from, you can go look at it. She's also a contributing editor of City Journal. She's written several books. Articles on childhood and education have been published in different places, including the New York Times and the Washington Post. And her recent book is titled Marriage and Caste in America, Separate and Unequal Families in a Post-Marital Age, published by Ivan D., a publisher based in Chicago. We do have several people here. We will try to get everybody in, but again, folks will help us by trying to be brief. In fact, now the lines are all full, so we'll go first to Bloomington, Indiana. That's the next person in line. It's line number four. Hello.
Hi. I want to comment on the 70% out-of-wedlock birth rate among blacks, but would you repeat... What is the out-of-wedlock birth rate for non-blacks and for society as a whole?
Well, for whites, it's 25%, and for society, and then for Hispanics, it's about 49%, and then for the total population, it's 37%.
Wow. Anyway, about that 70% out-of-wedlock birth rate among blacks, it seems to me that for blacks, the tradition of marriage before childbirth was completely lost, virtually completely lost during the welfare days, because in those days, a single woman could get a welfare check for simply getting pregnant. If she was married, she didn't get a welfare check, but if she got pregnant out of wedlock, she got a nice, handsome welfare check. She might even get her own apartment. And some of the government housing projects, which were virtual welfare communities, there were almost no intact families in those projects, and those welfare communities have now become crime-ridden. They're centers of drugs and gangs and drive-by shootings, and the point is that when you lose the tradition of marriage, it has really serious social consequences. What do you think?
Well, I certainly agree with your later point that it has serious social consequences when you see a breakdown in marriage. As for your point about welfare, there's a disagreement even among conservatives about this. Charles Murray, who the previous caller mentioned, believes very strongly this was welfare-induced. That is, the breakdown of the black family was welfare-induced. My own view is that welfare enabled a cultural change in attitudes and behavior, because, as I mentioned before, Americans of all stripes were beginning to question the purpose of marriage and the meaning of marriage. I think it hit blacks harder, not just because welfare was available, but also because the family was more fragile to begin with.
Well, you know, social scientists don't agree about much.
That's
but
true.
But they agree, and I think you're agreeing also, that marriage has a great, intact families and the strength of the family has a great deal of social consequences. And when the family breaks down and marriage breaks down, it's unwholesome for society. And that's pretty well agreed by all social scientists, isn't it?
It is. There was a lot of resistance among social scientists in the 60s and 70s and 80s to this idea. When we saw the breakdown of marriage, most of them tried to reassure us that the kids were going to be fine. And along about the 90s, they couldn't resist anymore. The data was just too overwhelming. What they saw was that children who grew up in single-parent homes, away from their two biological parents, were at greater risk of, and I could give you a long list, but let me just give you a few ideas, a greater risk of poverty, a greater risk of drug abuse, alcohol abuse, of school failure, and of becoming single parents themselves. That's why I call it marriage and caste in America, because it becomes a self-perpetuating condition.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We will continue, and I think our next caller here is in... line number three in Champaign. So call her there. Line three? I guess not. Okay. Well, we do have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And if somebody else wants to call, they can certainly do that. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Something I'm interested in also in having you talk about that you write about in the book is after a lot of bad news You conclude actually with a section where you write some things about what attitudes of younger people are towards the idea of marriage. And in fact, I almost, you know, I went, after having read some of the front sections of the book, I went to that, to the concluding chapter of the book, and I almost felt like it didn't belong with the book somehow. In a sense that the message was, it was a very different sort of a message. And actually, given the fact that the cast of the book is a little on the pessimistic side, the conclusion is actually rather, seems to me, and you can tell me if I'm reading this wrong, seems to be actually rather optimistic.
Well, what you're picking up is that this book is really a collection of previously published essays, and I think that should have been made clearer by the publisher than it was. So I think that the later essays that you're referring to, the more optimistic ones, were written perhaps earlier than the others. But I wanted to include them not just because I wanted to fatten out the book, but because I wanted to make a point, which is that cultural conditions can change. Cultural attitudes can change. And after this, after the marital revolution, the unmarriage revolution, as I call it, of the 60s and 70s and 80s, it took place, there was a kind of regrouping that you saw among a lot of middle-class young people who said, you know what, I still think marriage is important, and I want to be married. What I pointed out in those later essays is how strongly people, young people, believed in marriage and how much they wanted to have their own families and to have that as part of their lives. In the 70s, if you were listening to some of the dominant ideologies of the time, you might not have concluded that people would reach that conclusion, but they did. You're right that a lot of the book is much more pessimistic than that, and depending on the day, in general, I think I am more pessimistic that we can see much change. But I think that it's, you know, one of the ways that I would hope that we might be able to at least start a discussion is to understand how much marriage, the breakdown of marriage, has affected us disproportionately, is really contributing to inequality and to continuing poverty rates that we shouldn't see in a country of our wealth.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least I suppose it does make me think about the fact that sometimes social trends and attitudes, it's like the proverbial pendulum, and often it's not, it swings a little bit. It swings a whole lot, and it at least among, say, middle class people, that children who came of age in the 60s were, in a sense, reacting against some of the things in their parents' relationship that they weren't really sure was the way to go, and that now children who are coming of age, they're still doing that, although they've now maybe swung somewhat to the other side.
Well, I think there is, we're kind of at a tipping point, or rather at an unclear point as far as marital attitudes go. People still speak very, very strongly about wanting to get married. But at the same time, as I indicated in the story I told about the Vice columnist from the online magazine, at the same time, they're very reluctant to think of this as having much to do with children, and they still believe very, very strongly that people should, do what they want when it comes to having kids. If they want to be single when they have kids, that's fine. So they want marriage, but they're not sure how much it has to do with kids. So I think that is still, those attitudes are still rather dangerous for the future.
All right. Well, let's take some other calls in the time that we have left. We have about 7-8 minutes. A couple of people here in Urbana. Let's go next to line 2 in Urbana. Hello. Is there a caller there on line 2 in Urbana? Oh, hold on. We got you. There, we got you. Go ahead.
Is that me?
Yes, go ahead. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hey, I think you make a very compelling case for the importance of gay marriage being legalized. Could you give your comments on that?
Yes, I don't see it that way. Here's the problem. What we now know is that it's children who are growing up with their married biological parents who are doing best. We don't have a lot of data on the children who are growing up with gay parents. It's simply a new enough and small enough phenomenon that we just don't have big numbers. Most of the studies that have been done look at, 30 families tops, that kind of thing. So we just don't know. But my worry is about gay marriage is that it once again says that the most important thing is this relationship between the two adults, that what determines whether you're married or whether you should be married or how you decide to be married is whether you love this other person and not whether you are raising a family together. Now, this, you know, the fact that a lot of gays are raising children doesn't allow us to then think about, well, but who are the children? That is, there are biological parents who are not being included in that arrangement. And that's where I think I'm concerned about gay marriage. Those children are not growing up with their biological parents by definition. Whether that will, we'll see the results in the outcomes yet, I don't know.
I think the danger with a lot of this is that when someone comes at it with, everybody comes at it with their own political agenda, and it's easy to grab data to support one's political agenda. So I actually hope we'll revisit this issue with folks from other political agendas. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'm sure that we will talk with other people who have different orientations. We certainly have in the past. This is not the first conversation we've ever had on a subject like this, and it certainly won't be the last.
Yeah, I want to also clarify, it's interesting. I do talk about gay marriage briefly in the book, but not a lot. I think that my argument has implications about gay marriage. Your caller had, drew one implication. I reached another, and I just want to be clear, the book is not specifically about gay marriage. It's really, though, it really should inspire you to think about, well, what is marriage as a social institution? What does it accomplish? Where does it take us? Why does it seem to be so important for children's well-being?
I guess I'm still, forgive me, I guess I'm still not exactly sure what the problem is with beginning, and I would assume that most people do begin with the very idea of marriage thinking about, do we love this other person?
Oh, I don't mean to argue that they shouldn't. I mean, hopefully have a love relationship one that will last. What I'm saying is that the emphasis is so much and so entirely on the adult happiness that it leads to more marital breakdown, less focus on the well-being of children, and inevitably then to the question of, well, why shouldn't you have a child without being married? Because if it is about adult happiness and adult fulfillment, then of course they should be able to have adults should be able to have children without being married.
Let's get at least one more. This is Urbana, line 3. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes?
Yes. I'm curious in regard to an earlier caller. What is the out-of-wedlock birth rate among whites with poverty-level incomes?
I don't know that specific number, I'm afraid.
Do you know what the out-of-wedlock rate among blacks with moderate to high income, say better than $50,000?
I don't have an immediate breakdown on that, but I can tell you, as I mentioned before, if you have 70% of blacks who are having children outside of, or 70%, excuse me, 70% of black children are born to unmarried mothers, then you can be sure that a lot of middle-class blacks are having children without being married. That's true. I don't have percentages, though.
Don't you think those are highly important?
I do, and I will look them up. I'm not sure, let me put it this way. I can promise you that if you look at the middle-class blacks and higher-earning blacks, a far higher percentage of those will be married than low-income blacks. So,
I'm thinking about 18th and 19th century England. I don't think marriage was a very popular institution among the lowest class. It seems to me your thesis that this is a caste problem has great merit, and that's why I asked those questions.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's any possibility that the if I got the breakdown on the black numbers, that it wouldn't conform to what I've been saying. That is, you will find more blacks, middle-class blacks who are unmarried, middle-class black parents who are unmarried, but you will also find that the breakdown is such that a much higher proportion of the married blacks will be in higher income.
Well, this, I guess it makes me think of when back when we were talking more about welfare and welfare reform, the criticism or the point being made, some people would say, you know, the impression the media would give you is your typical welfare recipient is a young black woman, when in fact your typical welfare recipient in the United States was a poor white woman.
Right.
And that I guess it goes to this, to the wanting to raise the question, well, what really is driving out of wedlock birth, or what's a more important factor? Is it ethnicity or is it poverty? Is it socioeconomic status? And I think there are people who would argue, well, it's really about socioeconomic status.
Well, again, let's be careful when we're talking about cause and effect here. I don't think low income is driving the poor marriage rates among low income people. We are agreed that you're more likely to find low income people. Rather, it's not a black problem, it's a low income problem. I think the black situation is kind of sui generis. But you know, let's be careful about cause and effect. Sometimes people assume because fewer low-income people are getting married or they're less likely to be married when they have their children that is because they're low-income. I don't believe that. Hmm. I think that by not getting married, they are reinforcing the chances that they will stay low-income. And we know, you know, when you compare people, couples who do not marry and just cohabit, for instance, and they have their kids, who are, you know, same income level, same education level, same low income level, same low education level, and those who do marry, you find that the married couples experience less hardship than the cohabiting couples, and their relationships tend to last longer.
We're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have some callers we can't take. I can promise you we will again on other days with other guests be talking about some of these same issues. If you're interested in reading some more from our guest, Kay Heimowitz, you might look at her recent book, Marriage and Caste in America, Separate and Unequal Families in a Post-Marital Age. Ivan D. is the publisher. Kay Heimowitz is a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute in New York City. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.